Good evening, everyone. Welcome back for a new season. Just before we start, I want to say that one of the reasons I do this is in memory of a good friend of ours, Danny Ravitz, who sadly passed away at a young age, and we studied with him for many years, and I just want to return the favor, so I want to acknowledge him off the top of the evening. So, tonight we're going to talk about gun control in the Talmud, and I want to give some ground rules to this. So, first of all, there will be no politics. There, Talmud class is a politics-free zone, and I hope it will always stay that way. So, we're not going to talk about anything that's in the news tonight. Number two, we are not really even going to be talking about American gun control because we're talking about the Talmud. We're not talking about the Second Amendment in America. So clear that out of your mind. This is not a whether gun control in America in 2017 is good or not. It's how does the Talmud view weapons? And hopefully the idea is that we will get basic Jewish principles about weapons that can apply to your own informed views of what you think of as gun control. So, because obviously there were no guns in the ancient world, but there were plenty of weapons. It was actually a somewhat violent time. So, having said that, now before I even pass this out, so thinking about that made me start thinking about really what is gun control in the first place. And of course, I went to Wikipedia, and I went to the dictionary, and the definition of gun control is government regulation of the selling, owning, and use of firearms. Now, what underlies these definitions? What's really behind it? That's the Talmud question. Anybody? Well, why does the government have an interest in this, or why is there a need to regulate this?
Because you don't want small children getting weapons, or people that are...
The belief of the danger of weapons.
That was my answer. Basically, you have a deadly weapon that can kill another person. And that's what really this whole debate's all about. Okay. So, thinking further upon it, what I tried to do is break this down into a set of principles that build on each other, and that's what we're going to talk about. And those are the basics for which you can apply this to the whole gun control debate. So there's going to be a series of principles. Now, of course, this is something I've talked about a lot in the past. Right, in Judaism and in American law, you have two sides of the balance. You have rights, things that are due to you, and you have responsibilities, things that you have to do for others or discharge to the state, to God, to fellow human beings. And that's what I want to kind of peel the onion and get to those layers and talk about what the rights and obligations are at each point. So I've tried to break it up, and that's in the source notes. If you look at the red things, what do we have? And I'm kind of going from start to finish. Okay, so all that is kind of introduction. And the first principle, which comes from the Torah, is your obligation to protect, not only to protect, to take care of yourself, to be healthy. And that comes from this verb in Deuteronomy, chapter 4, verse 9. Rak hishamer lecha, only that you should guard yourself, watch yourself. Ushmor nafshecha me'od, and guard your soul greatly, very much. And, of course, like most of the Talmudic texts that are used to prove something, it's kind of wrenched out of context. But this is the basis of you, as a Jew, have an obligation to protect your own health. Okay. First thing. Second thing is, you have no right to murder another human being. And that's in the Ten Commandments, Lo Tirzach. And this one is a pet peeve of mine because it's almost always mistranslated as thou shalt not kill. That is not what the Hebrew says. There's killing and there's murder. In America, what's the difference? Murder is illegal killing. Killing is taking another life. Murder is unlawfully taking another life. There are two different words in Hebrew, which has the same distinction. So we say lo tirzach, ratzach is to murder, taharog would be to kill. And the commandment does not say lo taharog. It says lo tirzach. So, very important.
Is there any place in the Torah where they use the verb?
Taharog? Actually, they probably do. We'll see later on, but I don't have the Hebrew for it. So, in the Ten Commandments, murder, and it's a very big thing, as I hope we'll see as we continue on. Okay. You have to watch your own self. You have no right to murder somebody else. Now, this is one of the famous, very surprising pieces of Talmud, which is really the crux of the matter, as you'll see as we go on. So, from the Babylonian Talmud in Bava Metzia, if two are traveling on a journey, and the journey is through the desert, doesn't say that, and one of them has a flask of water, if they both drink, they will both die. There's not enough water for both of them to survive. But if only one person drinks, he can reach civilization. Ben Petura taught, it is better both should drink and die, rather than one should behold his companion's death. Which is kind of the commonsensical, that's what you'd expect, answer. But then along comes Rabbi Akiba, one of the most famous rabbi in the Talmud, probably, or at least one of, and he taught that your brother may live with you, which is a quote from Leviticus, and says your life takes precedence over his life. And the quote is below, Al tikach me'ito neshech v'tarbit. Do not take from him. Now, neshech and tarbit are actually financial terms. They are both terms of interest, as in monetary interest, usury, that kind of thing. Neshech is interesting because it literally means a bite. So this is again out of context, but it's the end that counts. V'yareta me'elohecha, and you will fear your God. V'chai achicha, and your brother will live imach, with you, in you. So what the rabbis have done is taken the last three words here, that your brother will live with you, and the spin they put on it is, you have to live first in order for your brother to live with you. And that's where they decide your life is foremost over his life. So Akiba is teaching a lesson which is really kind of radical, which is saying if your life comes before your fellow's life, you don't have to die for them. Yeah.
Well, isn't that sort of analogous to the... riding in an airplane and oxygen mask drops, and you put the oxygen mask over yourself first, and then you can treat the child.
I think that's for a different reason, honestly. I think it's because a kid needs help and you don't need help, so you can help them better if you're
alive.
Okay. But there's some of that, too.
But in that situation, there's enough oxygen for everybody. It's just a matter of who gets the oxygen, for who puts on the mask first.
Yeah.
In this hypothetical, there's only enough water for one. So it's a little bit of a difference.
Yeah.
Right, but it's your water. Now, we're going to come back to this at length. So just keep that in the back of your mind.
The mask and the oxygen mask, people more vulnerable, naturally you give it first. Older people or...
No, no, but the point that she's making, if I'm sitting next to an elderly person who has limited mobility, I'm supposed to put my mask on first and then help them. And the idea is that I'm better able to help them when I can breathe very easily than to sit there and maybe have a problem and then have trouble again, you know, putting my own mask on.
Which is true.
What Lawrence just said, there was plenty of oxygen there. It was just like an extra precaution.
It's true, but I would say the Jewish answer is you have the obligation to protect your own life before you help somebody else. And we'll see in a few minutes the extreme of that, because there'll be a more realistic situation. So that's something to keep in your own mind. And again, always in the back of your mind, think about a gun somewhere. So it'll all play into it. So yes, you have an obligation to protect your own life, but not at the cost of other lives. So now come some qualifications here. So, again from the Talmud, the question really before the rabbis here is there anything that supersedes your right to your own life? In other words, if your choice is do this or die, normally you have to die. Normally you do this. But there are three things, the big three, as Danny used to call it, the cardinal three. There are three things that supersede that you have to die rather than do it. So two of them are here. Forbidden sexual relations and murder may not be practiced to save one's life. Meaning, well, I'll read this. How do we know that this of murder itself? It is common sense. Now, this is interesting in and of itself, because normally in the Talmud, things are derived from other texts, what we call proof texts. But here is something called svara, which is common sense. They're not deriving it, they're just saying, this is obvious. This is reason. Even as one who came before Rava said to him, the governor of the town has ordered me, go and kill so-and-so. If not, I will slay you. He answered to him, let him rather slay you than you should commit murder, and this is the reason. Who knows that your blood is redder? Perhaps his blood is redder. So in other words, if someone breaks into my house right now and says, Steve, kill Lawrence or I'll shoot you, I can't kill Lawrence. I have to let myself be shot. Because there's no way to say, my life is more important than his. Therefore, I can't accede to that request. So I said there's three exceptions to that. So one is if you're asked to murder. The other is forbidden sexual relations, meaning incest. Once again, if the guy breaks in the house, puts a gun to my head and says, you have to have relations with your niece, I have to let him kill me. And the third one is idol worship, which is not in this text. So those are the big three.
So that means that the Talmud doesn't consider not giving someone water, even though you know they're going to die, murder. In other words, they're distinguishing between intentional murder and you're doing something where you know the other person is going to die, but you didn't force that. You didn't force that.
Exactly so. Exactly so. And again, that's going to be the crux of the issue in a minute when we get to the big next paragraph. All right, so now we're on page 2. And just one more example of this, which is kind of sad. This always makes me think of the Nazis. Similarly, women who have been told by non-Jews, give us one of you that we may defile her, we may rape her. If not, we will rape you all. Let the non-Jews rape them all, and do not hand over to them one soul from Israel. So once again, you have no obligation to do that. And there's similar examples with it's always in the sense of non-Jewish troops are surrounding your city and they say, send out one person for us to kill or we'll kill the whole city. You don't have to do it. But interestingly, if they give that person a name, like if they say, send out Aaron, you send out Aaron. Because it's assumed that he's guilty of something. I'm just telling you the way it works.
Always looks a little suspicious to me.
Well, I didn't want to pick on Lawrence for a second time.
You said you didn't have to do it, but does that mean you can do it?
No, you can't do it.
Okay.
You can't do it because it violates rule number two, which is murder. Even though you're not killing the person, someone else is killing the person. And hold on to that, because again, that's back to what Lawrence was saying about intent, because intent will become the defining issue here.
Did they by any chance talk about if that kind of situation where it's, you know, send us one person or we'll, you know, level your city. What if somebody says, I don't, you know, I have my family here, I don't want them all to die. I'm going to go out and they can kill me, so hopefully my family will live.
I would say, I don't recall seeing that example, but I would say by the law here, you are not allowed to do that.
Yeah, but at the same time, I could see somebody saying, you know, everybody I love is here. If they're going to kill me anyway, what if I voluntarily do it and then maybe they have a chance to live?
You're saving lives.
Right, and that's a question. And if you go to this last example, and this is important, you know, what's the difference between that example and the two people in the desert? And I think the difference is not giving water to your neighbor is a passive action, but actively pointing out kill Aaron is an active thing. And there's a big difference between a passive and an active.
Mm-hmm.
Which now leads me into the Chazon Ish, who was a great rabbinical figure, and some of you may recall he was very prominent in the long discussion we had about electricity on Shabbat. He was a great halakhic authority. He died in the 50s, so in the last century. And he came up with kind of a spin on this. So he posits an example here. We may consider the case of one who sees an arrow which is about to kill many people. And he can deflect it to the other side where it will only kill one person, and those on the other side will be saved. But if he does nothing, many will be killed and one will remain alive. Now, this is actually coming from a true story. So, obviously an arrow doesn't do that. And what the Chazon Ish was commenting on was a real-life case that happened in the War of Independence in Israel when there were soldiers in a foxhole and a grenade was thrown into the soldiers. And what the soldier did was the grenade came and he pushed it down the foxhole where there were other soldiers. And there arose in Israel a big debate of, was that an ethical action? That's the arrow in this story, right? Because the argument goes, the soldier is not intending to kill his fellow soldiers. The soldier is merely preserving his own life. He doesn't have that intent. And he doesn't stop to think, well, what happens if I push the grenade over? How many other people will die? So the Chazon Ish is defending that action.
I would think that that would almost be instinctual. That, you know, it's like if there's, I don't know, something that's on fire coming towards you, it's your normal instinct to push it away. And if you push it into somebody else and then they get emoliated, that wasn't your intention. It was just, you didn't even think about it. You just did it.
Right, and that is the Chazon Ish's opinion. So to read the rest of this, perhaps this case is not the same as the case of turning over one to be killed. For the turning over is a cruel act of killing a person, and the act itself is not one of saving lives by nature. Merely it happens in this situation to cause the savings of others. Also, the saving of others is connected to the turning over of the person to be killed. But the deflection of an arrow from one side to the other is in essence an act of saving, and not at all connected to the killing of one of the other side. Only it happens there is a person on the other side, and since on this side many will be killed, and on this only one, perhaps we should attempt to minimize the loss in whatever way possible. So he's making the argument that it's better to let that one person be killed than the many people be killed, which is really not what the halakha is about protecting your own life and not murdering others. Still, here it is worse because he is killing directly, and it has only been permitted to surrender someone, but perhaps it is not permitted to kill directly. So this was and is, because I'm going to tell you now, there's no answer. And this is where you kind of think for yourself of what makes sense. So this is very popular now in classes on ethics, and I've seen this. And there's a guy at Harvard, actually, that does a whole, if you've heard of this, Sandel? I don't know. He teaches a course. This is called the trolley problem.
Yeah, and Danny Kahneman did it also with Dr. Prusman.
Okay, so the modern saying of this is you're in a train, and the train is headed down the tracks, and you see in front of you, you know, 10 people on the tracks. And if you don't do something, the train's going to kill all 10 people. But there's a switch, and if you flip the switch on the tracks, you'll divert the train, but then you'll kill only one person. Is it ethical to flip the switch? And I don't have the answer for you. I'm giving you the question, and there's a lot of variations about this. The most devilish one is people will say, okay, well, it's better to kill one person than 10 people, so I should do that.
Then what if you know the person?
And then the next one is, well, what if the one person is your son? And, you know, again, how do you answer that?
Differently.
And it's the trolley problem is not the same as the one we're dealing with, because in the trolley case,
that's an instinctive thing where you're, like what you said, where it's fire, you have an actual real choice that you're making.
Well, not only that, it's your life. In the trolley problem, you're not going to be killed either way.
Mm-hmm.
But when the grenade comes at you, you have to make a decision.
Yeah.
It's your choice.
But I would even argue that you're not even making a conscious decision. The same way that if, I don't know, you're walking in a park and, you know, a ball comes at you that you're not going to be able to catch, that you kind of bat it away because you don't want it to hit you in the head. It wasn't, and nobody gets hurt in that situation. But I think when something's coming at you, whether it's fire or grenade or whatever, I think it's just an instinct to kind of bat it away. I don't think the soldier was saying, gee, I want to save my life and somebody else is going to die.
So as it turns out, this is actually a 1,000-year-old problem in Talmudic thinking that goes all the way back to the Meiri, who was a rabbi who lived in Provence in 1200, and he was doing a mental, like a trolley problem of his own. And he gave an example of, imagine you have a lifeboat, and on the side of the lifeboat, it says very clearly, only one person can stay in this lifeboat, and there's two of you. So if you both stay in the lifeboat, you'll both die. One person has to get out in order for one to live. Now who gets out? Each person in the lifeboat thinks the other one should get out. If they don't do anything, they both die. And that's worse than just one person dying. On the other hand, there's always another hand here, better to have two passive deaths than one active murder. Right? That's kind of clear by Jewish law. And that's a 1,000-year-old problem. In the last century, the halakhic authority of the century was a man named Moshe Feinstein. He even went a step further and said, you can't jump off the boat, because then you're committing suicide, and you violate the prime directive of protecting your own life. And there's no answer to this.
You're going to die anyway, but essentially you've committed suicide anyway, because if you both stay, you're going to die. So you've essentially committed suicide anyway.
But you've done it passively and not actively.
See, I don't know if I really, in that situation, really buy that difference. I mean, you're not passive. You know, I guess...
No, I think you're making a valid point.
If this were a movie, you know, who knows that the ship's not going to come by as you're both laying there going, water, water.
Well, no, I'm assuming that they say that the two can't fit because it'll sink.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that in either situation, if you both stay, you're going to die because the boat's going to sink. And if you jump out...
A raft may come by before the boat sinks. Next time.
Well, maybe you could.
Well, I don't know.
You jump out and you could float, maybe.
Presumably,
you could
see something.
So, I guess either way, you could possibly live. But, in any event, it's a quandary with no real.
It is a quandary. And what it comes down to is, and now you can think about guns, right? Here's the trade-off. More deaths and fewer murders versus more murders and fewer deaths. Right? If you have a gun, there's going to be more murders. But if you don't have a gun, there may be more deaths. And you've got to weigh that. So that's really what the gun issue comes down to. That's, as I said, that's kind of the core issue. I'll just stop here for a minute. One of the things I did preparing for this is I listened to a podcast by a rabbi. And this is an Orthodox rabbi with a long white beard who has a congregation in Atlanta. And he talks about the fact that congregants come to shul carrying weapons in Atlanta.
In Georgia, yeah. And it's a totally different world.
And that's what he says. It's a totally different world. He says, where I live...
Not on Shabbos.
Yeah, even on Shabbos. Well, I imagine he gets like police officers and emergency people.
Oh,
we'll talk about it at the very end. Okay, so that's a good point. But he's, what's fascinating is he says, and I don't know the statistics, he says it's very different than what we are used to here in the North, meaning people in Atlanta carry guns. So there are fewer burglaries. There are fewer, you know, stick-ups in stores. Because if you're sitting there thinking, I'm going to rob you, and I don't know if you're carrying a gun, you think twice about it. But on the other side of the coin, there are many more suicides, because that's the most popular way to commit suicide. And there's
deaths.
More accidental deaths.
That's where I went the other day, or like a 4-year-old went to her.
I saw that. Yeah, found the gun. So again, it's a difficult trade-off. And you know, he was saying this.
Well, I was just listening to the radio the other day, and this to me was counterintuitive, but I guess after a lot of these incidents, there are a lot more people that go out to get a gun. And they said that over the course of the past year, there's been an increase of 48% rise in people getting guns. There's been a 25% diminution in deaths that related to guns. So apparently, in spite of the fact that there are so many more people that have guns, fewer people are getting shot. So it's, to me, that was counterintuitive, but that's what the numbers say. And that's amazing.
Yeah, it's, you know, statistics is a very hard thing to know when it comes to gun things. As I was quoting the other day, I don't know who's read the book Freakonomics, but two economists who tease out information from data, and they start the book off by saying, you know, you have a kid, and he can go down the street and play at either of two neighbors' houses. One neighbor has a pool, one neighbor has a gun. Which is safer? And it turns out there are 10 times as many pool deaths as there are gun deaths. So counterintuitively, it's better to send your kid over to the gun family than the pool family. Okay. So this leads us to the next item now. So again, that's kind of the core of the debate. But to go on in the Jewish vein, so now we get to another level. You have an obligation to prevent the inadvertent deaths and injuries, of course, of other people. So this comes from the Torah, Deuteronomy. This is the core text for all of these discussions. When you build a new house, you shall make a guardrail for your roof. They had flat roofs in those days, and they actually slept on the roof and lived on the roof. So you shall not cause blood to be spilled in your house, that the one who falls should fall from it. That's the literal text of the Hebrew. So Rashi comments on that. The one who would fall deserves to fall to his death on account of sins. What he's commenting on is the strange language of the last part of this verse. The one who falls should fall from it. So what Rashi is saying here is, you might think that the guy who falls off the roof and dies deserves it because he's a bad person and God is punishing him for his sin. But Rashi goes on to say, you should not be the one to bring about his death, even if he deserves it, is what he's really saying. For meritorious things are executed through meritorious people, while things of ill fortune are executed through guilty people. In other words, if you're a good person, it's not your responsibility to see that a bad person gets punished on your own recognizance. That's the court's decision to make. So please, the lawyers here. Then we have another comment by Rabbeinu Bechaya in the medieval period. According to the plain meaning of the text, the commandment is an example of how one is to guard against dangers to life and limb on one's property. And seeing such considerations are a major concern of the Torah. The Torah here legislates the affixing of a railing to one's roof. And here's what's interesting. The sages taught us as a corollary of this commandment, if someone raises a dog trained to bite, or puts a shaky ladder inside his house, or another Talmudic example is digs a pit, he is liable for the harm caused thereby. So in other words, the plain meaning here is you need to be very vigilant about your own property, your own possessions. Once again, think of guns, that they shouldn't inadvertently cause harm to other people. That is an obligation to you as a Jew. And here we have a comment on that now from the Babylonian Talmud. Rabbi Nathan says, whence it is derived, or from where is it derived, nobody should breed a bad dog in his house. This is when we need the dog next door to bark. Or keep an impaired ladder in his house. We learn it from the text. You bring not blood upon your house. And that's the verse from Deuteronomy back that we had started. That's, again, what they're deriving from the language of it. You shall cause, if they're saying literally, you shouldn't have blood being spilled in your house because of something in your house. That's where it comes from. Now we go to Maimonides in the early 1100s. There is no difference between a roof or anything else that is dangerous or likely to cause death to a person who might stumble. Read gun. If, for instance, one has a well or a pit in his courtyard, he must build an enclosing ring or put a cover over it so a person should not fall and die. So any obstruction that is danger to life must be removed as a matter of positive duty. In other words, it's an active obligation, not a passive obligation, to protect, and extremely necessary caution. And I put it in here so you see the language, that this is not just a casual mitzvah, this is a very strong mitzvah. Don't do that. Always makes me think of the cartoon thing, you know, where the rake's on your lawn and the guy steps on it and comes up and hits him in the head. You can't do that. Okay, so this is kind of like now, on the other hand, so all this stuff is about, you have to be really careful not to cause harm to other people.
So this is kind of reducing the distinction that you were making between intentional and non-intentional. Now they're saying that you also do have an obligation not to do something that passively that could lead to an injury.
Yeah, I would say there's a slight difference in that there's intent involved in the first case and not in the second case. I mean, I leave the rake on the lawn. I don't have an intent to harm anyone.
Right, but they're saying that's still not good, though. That's what
but
I'm
it's
saying.
Still bad.
It's still not allowed, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and it's still almost equal, I would say, with, you know, actively killing someone or hurting someone. I think of these cases where you know, people have remote cabins and they wire up shotguns so that if someone breaks in, the shotgun gets you.
Yeah, it's one of the first cases you read in law school in torts.
Oh, is that true? And what's the law school answer? Guilty or not guilty?
Well, it wasn't a criminal case, it's a civil case, and you can be liable.
Okay.
Before that, you weren't liable to trespassers, and the California Supreme Court said, changed and said, in that case,
he
said, yeah, you could be liable to trespassers.
That's interesting. And it leads us right into the next section. At the same time,
have a net over them.
You can't cause danger. You do have a solid right to protect yourself from attackers. Babylonian Talmud. Rav Huna said, a miner in pursuit may be slain to save the pursued. And that, which you also may recall, that one line is the basis of therapeutic abortion in Judaism. Because a fetus that is causing harm to the life of the mother is considered as a pursuer who's chasing the mother to kill her. And you not only have the ability to do it, you have the obligation to kill the baby, or the fetus, I should say, first, to protect the life of the mother.
Yeah.
That's kind of solid Jewish law.
Sure, sure.
As is the next quote, so from Exodus. If while breaking in the thief is discovered and he is struck and dies, he has no blood. If the sun shone upon him, he has blood. He shall surely pay. If he has no money, he shall be sold for his theft. All the he's in that refer to the thief. So what this is saying is a thief breaks into your house, you have a right, not an obligation, you have a right to kill him. I don't know if it's an obligation, to be honest. My guess is not, but I don't know what the law is on that. So once again, we have commentary on the verse by Rashi. So again, it's strange language. He has no blood. And Rashi understands that to mean this signifies he is not. It is not considered murder. It is as though the thief was considered dead from the start. Here the Torah teaches you, and this is a very famous line in Judaism, if someone comes to kill you, get up earlier and kill him first. And this one has come to kill you, this one meaning the thief. Why? Because he knows that no one can hold himself back and remain silent when he sees people taking his money. Therefore, the thief has come with the acknowledgement that the owner of the property were to stand up against him, the owner would kill him. What is the saying? If the thief came into your house during the day and you saw him, you would know this is a thief, and you would yell at him or shake him, you know, call the police, get him out of your house. But if he comes at night, he's doing that because he knows he's not going to encounter you, and he's acknowledging that if you did see him, in this case, you would kill him. So it is okay to kill. In a sense, he's like a pursuer. You could kill him first. I don't know if that came out intelligibly, but that's what I meant to say. Isn't that the difference, someone help me, between robbery and burglary?
Yes.
Right? Burglary is when you're not home, and robbery is when you are. So they understand the distinction here. Similarly, the other part of the verse, if the sun shone upon him, this is nothing but a metaphor that if the matter is clear to you, the thief is peaceably disposed toward you, similar to the sun, which represents peace in the world. So it is obvious to you he has not come to kill you. In other words, that's talking about the thief comes during the day. He knows the rules. He knows you're not going to use deadly force on him. Even if the owner of the money rises against him, for instance, and this is a famous example in the Talmud, what if a father breaks into a son's house to steal his money? Right? We know that the father might want to steal his money, but we know the father doesn't want to kill him. So that's a clear-cut case. And he hasn't come to the idea of murdering him, but it's not true of a thief. So that's the differentiation. Okay. So now we have, this is the last case of you know, murder, not murder, what it is. Now we come down to what I would call secondary consideration, which is weapons. All right, what's our obligation towards selling weapons to people? And again, there's a lot of material in the Talmud about this. I should always make the constant warning that, you know, we're taking bits and pieces of this, so don't necessarily think that what's here is the answer to everything. It's my answer to everything. Okay. So what are we talking about here? It has further been taught, one should not sell to them. This is them are non-Jewish neighbors. Either weapons or accessories of weapons. Nor should one sharpen any weapon for them. Nor may one sell them stocks or neck chains or ropes or iron chains. Neither to idolaters. And here the Talmud is always, you know, between idolaters, non-Jews, heathens, the languages get censored, it's not always clear. But clearly, people who are not Jews in your community, nor Kutians, who are Samaritans, who have their own whole history. Samaritans are kind of crypto-Jews. They're kind of Jewish, but not really. Talmud does not like Samaritans. Which is why, by the way, Christians have the parable of the Good Samaritan, because they know Samaritans are bad guys. Said Rabbi Ada Bar Ahava, one should not sell them bars of iron. Why? Because they may hammer weapons out of them. So, not only can you sell them the weapon, you can't sell them the things that can let them make a weapon. It's actually even one step stricter. I guess we might say...
They have the hammer, they have a weapon already.
Okay, and that's the next comment. If so, spades and pickaxes should be forbidden. Said Rabbi Zvid, we mean bars of Indian iron. Now, this is actually Indian. So people in Talmudic times knew of India. It says Hindu in the Hebrew. What is that? So Indian iron is a special kind of iron that is used only to make weapons. Apparently a finer. Maybe it's like Damascus steel or something like that. Why then do we sell it now? And this is what's really interesting. Said Rabbi Ashi, we sell it to the Persians who protect us. So,
not today.
Very good, yes. So, context is everything. Even in Talmudic times, they are saying, don't sell weapons to the bad guys, but it's okay to sell it to the good guys. So it's not clear-cut at all. If you wanted to apply it to today, to guns, you might say, sell a gun to someone who has a thorough background check. Don't sell it to someone who has a criminal past or who fails a background check. Just suggesting, as I say. I'm not advocating either way. Maimonides' laws of murder. One may not sell non-Jews weapons. Now, this is 1,000 years later, remember. One may not sharpen their weapons. One may not sell them knives, manacles, or chains. Not bears or lions, or any object which can damage to the public, but we do sell them shields which are only for defense. So Maimonides is kind of, he's moved off, and you know, in the Talmud it says accessories of weapons. But here he's moved off and he's saying, okay, defensive things are good, and the question again would be, would a gun be considered a defense or a weapon? I don't know the answer to that.
But instead of any weapon, I mean, you could say that same thing for the manacles and knives could be used for defense also.
Right. So it's not clear, but it's kind of moving along. Now, along comes the Nimuke Yosef, who's a Sephardic rabbi in 1400. He's probably in Spain or Northern Europe. Nowadays, we sell weapons to idolaters that are fully assembled because they protect us. They fight on our behalf to protect the city and its inhabitants, and there is a definite protection from danger. Whereas there is only a small possibility they might use them to harm a member of the Jewish community, and this is what we rely on. So now, this opinion comes that much later. Once again, we sell it to the good guys, we don't sell it to the bad guys.
So it goes back to Rabbi Eshu and selling it to Persians.
As in, okay. Yes, yes. So I think the point of all of this is again, context is everything. Weapons to good guys, weapons to people who protect us, yes. Weapons to bad guys, weapons to people who want to kill us, no. Which again is kind of, to me, a lot of what the debate about selling guns is about. You know, selling guns to good people, okay. Selling guns to bad people, not okay. Finally, the last level of the chain here is the general view of weapons in the Talmud. So this is another famous piece of Talmud about Shabbat, and the question is, We know that one of the fundamental laws of Shabbat is you can't carry items from one domain to another. So what does a sword count as? Let me give the context here.
Because you can wear it in a sheath.
You can wear it. So I'm saying you can't carry a handkerchief on Shabbat. For that, you violate Shabbat and you're liable for the death penalty, literally. But a man puts a handkerchief in his pocket, he's not carrying it, he's wearing it. And the Talmud goes to long discussions on this, women's jewelry, items, etc. And what very observant people do to this day is house keys, they fashion them into a tie clasp or a belt buckle, and this way they're wearing the key and not carrying the key. So the question is posed, can I go out of my house on Shabbat wearing a sword, right, on the side? A man must not go out with a sword, bow, shield, lance, or spear on the Shabbat. And if he goes out, he must bring a sin offering. In other words, he's violated a law of Shabbat, and he needs to bring a sacrifice to compensate.
But not the death penalty.
Not the death penalty, which is interesting. Rabbi Eliezer said, they are ornaments for him. So in other words, he's wearing them. But the sages, and the sages win the debate, maintain they are merely shameful. So this is interesting. Not only do the sages say you can't do it, they're actually saying a weapon is worse than a handkerchief. It's actually something that's disgraceful to carry a weapon around on Shabbat. For it is said, and we all know this quote, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. In other words, we don't want to have swords. We don't want to have spears. We want to fashion them into non-weapons and something useful. And that may be the end of the debate, and just for surprising, to go all the way back to zero again, and I don't think most people know this, the opposite quote is also found in the Tanakh, in the book of Joel, where it says, beat your plowshares into swords, your pruning hooks into spears, let the weak say, I am strong. So in other words, carrying weapons, you are strong. Now, I have one more comment to read on this, which I think is historically also very interesting. On the one hand, the 13th century Spanish commentator Nachmanides, who's Ramban, not Rambam. Now, where do weapons come from? In the Torah, in the rabbi's view of the Torah world. So if you remember, between Adam and Noah, there's 10 generations, and there's a lot of names you see only once, like Tubal Cain. And there's another character in there, Lemach. Adam's great-great-grandson, mentioned in the fourth chapter of Genesis, taught his son to smelt metal. So as soon as you see the word metal, you think weapons. His wives protested. They worried that through this simple act, Lemach was bringing death into the world, since now humans would be able to make swords. However, Lemach, according to Nachmanides' interpretation, replied to his wives that murder existed before there were weapons. Right? After all, his great-grandfather Cain killed his brother Abel with his bare hands. This story is perhaps the oldest variation on the phrase made famous on so many bumper stickers, swords don't kill people, people kill people. And with that, as I said, you can now go out and apply these principles to your own discussions and thoughts and arguments about gun control.
Stop at the nearest gun shop.
And he'll carry it on Chiffon into Neve.
If we're not in Georgia.
You know, but now he has the other thing that I wonder about also.